wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That's a new sting, which I have not heard, and I wasn't told it was new. So let's get straight into it. Louis, you want to take it away? What are we talking about first this week?
We're talking about a helicopter that's gone to Mars.
Sweet. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yes, we are. Yeah, so as you probably heard already, NASA flew an aircraft on another planet. So this is the first time there has ever been a powered, controlled flight on another planet. And this happened at 10:46 p.m., or at least the data came back at 10:46 p.m. New Zealand time on Monday. And what happened is so I reported on this about 4 weeks ago, I think. The rover, the Ingenuity rover, the Perseverance rover dropped the Ingenuity helicopter about 3 or 4 weeks ago. They run through a whole bunch of tests, made sure it could stand a Martian night, which gets very, very cold, and slowly built up to this first flight. And so what happened was they spun up the rotor blades. The aircraft ascended about 10 feet, 3 meters or so, stayed there pretty still. If you look at the sort of a video that shows it, it really doesn't move very much, stays there for about 30 seconds, and then slowly came back down again. So this was in total about 39 seconds of flight, a little bit shorter than the Wright brothers' first flight, but the Wright brothers moved, they weren't hovering, and okay, it was on a beach in North Carolina, not on another planet, so they had a bit of an advantage. And there's going to be more details, there's more data on the way, and we'll learn more about what happened and how it performed. But it was an autonomous flight, so it did it itself. It's impossible because of the sheer distance between the Earth and Mars. You can't sit there with a joystick and control a remote sort of aircraft on Mars because the delay is just too big. And so it had to be autonomous. And it's so this is obviously a momentous feat, and hopefully paving the way to airborne exploration of Mars and maybe other planets as well. I know they've talked about doing powered flights on Titan, the moon of Saturn, which has quite a thick atmosphere, so they can explore there. So you obviously cover much more ground if you're in the air than if you're just rolling along the surface. They've named the site at which this first flight took place. They've named it Wright Brothers Field, obviously after those two pioneers. The location of the flight has also been given the ceremonial location designation JZRO for Jezero Crater, which is where it took place. So this is about a 50 centimeter tall helicopter. It's really just a technology demonstration. And the difficulties of Mars, the gravity is about one third that of Earth's, but the atmosphere is extremely thin. It's only about 1% of the pressure at the surface compared to our planet. So there's relatively few air molecules for the rotors to push down onto, and so they had to spin extremely fast to get the flight. But it all seems to have worked. It was looked at by the Perseverance rover, which was parked about 64 meters away on a slightly higher ground on an overlook, so they could see it clearly. If you go online, YouTube has about a million copies of the video as it rises up and falls down again.
Anything you want to ask about that, Lloyd?
So you said that it was similar distance to the Wright brothers.
No, they didn't go anywhere. They just went up and down. The Wright brothers actually went, I don't know, 100 meters or so in powered flight. Gosh. But this was just up and down.
Sweet. Okay, so we'll move on to our next topic that we've got this week, where we are talking about T-Rexes.
Yeah, so this is a little alarming. If you were living, you know, 150 million years ago or so, turns out they've managed to from the fossil record, paleontologists have tried to estimate how many T-Rexes there were, Tyrannosaurus Rexes. And they used fossil data and statistical analysis, samples collected from around the world, Mexico, Canada, and other places. And this, it turns out that there were about 20,000 or so adults roaming the continent of North America at any one time. And over 2.5 million years, they were around for about 2.5 million years, which is a hell of a lot longer than we've been around, there was probably about 2.5 billion total. So that's quite a lot of T-Rexes.
What was the lifespan for a T-Rex?
It says here, yeah, about, I think they were using about 20 years, 19 or 20 years as the lifespan of a T-Rex.
What?
Yeah.
That's unexpectedly short.
Isn't it?
Maybe not from your scientific point of view.
I have no idea.
Sorry, if I was a T-Rex, I'd be in a rest home somewhere.
Yes, basically. Long in the tooth, literally.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Anything else that we need to know about all these T-Rexes that existed so long ago?
Yeah. So they estimate that 2.5 billion lived and died. So how did they get this estimate? That's sort of the interesting part. So first of all, the uncertainties in this number are very, very big. So probably about two orders of magnitude. So 100-fold uncertainty. So if you look at the 95% confidence range, the numbers of T-Rexes around at any one time could vary from anywhere between about 1,300 to 330,000. So quite a wide range. So this analysis is not exactly precise. So the uncertainty centers around the questions of the exact nature of the dinosaur's ecology. And especially how warm-blooded T-Rex was. And it relies on data published by a guy called John Damuth in Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, that relates body mass to population density for living animals. So this is a relationship known as Damuth's Law. And this is a strong relationship, but the relationship depends on the ecology, the environment. So, for example, jaguars and hyenas are about the same size, but hyenas are found in their habitat at a density 50 times greater than the density of jaguars in their habitat. So there's a lot of variation here. So the calculations depended on this relationship and an estimate of this body mass of a T-Rex for them to be able to get an estimate of the population density. And then knowing how long they've been around for, that, you know, the total number of T-Rexes ever to have lived. As part of the calculations, so surprisingly, then the uncertainty is dominated by ecological variability and not necessarily uncertainty in the paleontological data. So they don't know enough about the environment to be able to make a good estimate, not necessarily about the T-Rexes themselves. The lifespan here, so his lifespan, oh, so late 20s was sort of the average lifespan that they were estimating here. The size of a T-Rex is about 5.2 tons, so it's pretty gigantic. Age of sexual maturity of a T-Rex was about 15 years. So those are sort of the numbers they were using. When they got mature, they got to about 7 tons in weight. Is important because they can start to estimate how many geographically specialized species might be missing from the fossil record using this sort of analysis, and it may be a way of quantifying what paleontologists, if I can say that word, don't know about what species were around.
To me, it just sounds like we need a time machine.
They're working on that.
I hope so. I really hope so. I think dinosaurs, like, I think that's top of the list when it comes to having a time machine.
Yeah, I'd love to see how long you last among among the dinosaurs?
I think
James?
Yeah,
can you run fast with all those T-Rexes around? You're going to have to run.
Yeah, I think I'd be fine. So moving on to our last topic today, we're talking about human monkey embryos. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so I find this a bit creepy, and there's certainly ethical problems with this. So researchers have injected stem cells, human stem cells, into primate embryos, and they were able to grow chimeric embryos for a significant period of time, up to 20 days. And there's obviously ethical concerns to this research, but it has the potential to provide new insights into developmental biology and evolution. And it also has implications for developing new models of human biology and disease. So again, there's pretty big benefits, but obviously ethical concerns. So what happened is investigators in China and the United States injected these human stem cells into these embryos and found that some were able to last for up to 20 days, at which point they were terminated. The quote from one of the researchers is, as we're unable to conduct certain types of experiments in humans, it's essential that we have better models to more accurately study and understand human biology and disease. And an important goal of experimental biology is the development of model systems that allow for the study of human diseases in vivo and in the body in live conditions. And this is not a new field. So interspecies chimeras in mammals have been made since the 70s. They were first generated in rodents and used to study early developmental processes. In the current study, 6 days after the monkey embryos had been created, each one was injected with 25 human cells. These were from an induced pluripotent line known as an extended pluripotent stem cells, a particular type of stem cell, which have the potential to contribute to both embryonic and extra-embryonic tissues. After 1 day, human cells were detected in 132 embryos. After 10 days, 103 of the chimeric embryos were still developing, and the survival rate dropped quite precipitously, and by day 19, only 3 chimeras were still alive. Importantly, though, the percentage of human cells in the embryos remained high throughout the time they continued to grow. So they weren't necessarily rejected by the embryos. So historically, this has been a low efficiency process. But they're saying that being able to use primates, which is a species more closely related to humans along the evolutionary timeline, will allow them to gain better insight into whether they are evolutionarily imposed barriers to chimera generation, and if there are any means they can overcome them. In other words, they want to generate chimeras that last longer. So there's a lot of ethical considerations surrounding the generation of human, non-human primate chimeras, and it's the responsibility of scientists to conduct their research thoughtfully. This was from one of the researchers quoted, following all ethical, legal, and social guidelines in place. I think my concerns is ethical and legal guidelines usually take a while to catch up to, you know, the forefront of science. And do we really want to be creating human primate chimeras that could be lasting longer than 20 days? What do you think?
It's definitely scary. I think I see both sides. Yes, you've got science and the ability to take the human race to a new level where we're understanding more about ourselves and evolution, but at the same time, at the end of the day, that could become, is a living organism, which definitely raises a whole bunch of different issues and has always been an issue going forward with science, I feel.
But if you needed a new cornea or a new liver or something like that, and they could be generated from these chimeric cells, would you necessarily want to say no? Life was at stake.
I'm one of a few billion humans. I don't think I'll be missed. Sweet. Okay. Do you guys
is
have
that
anything?
Your official answer? That
was my official answer.
That's a cop out, I think.
Very diplomatic, James.
Yeah, I tried to be. Sweet. I think that's a Dear Science for this week. Thank you so much, Marcus.
You're very welcome.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.